I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
Over the past year, we've seen a pandemic, new vaccines, and continued changes to our global climate and environment. Science and science education are essential to our understanding of these big issues and our ability to find solutions. But just as the need to trust in science has grown, we've also seen how that trust has eroded by the spread of misinformation and the politicization of facts.
This week, we are speaking with Avisha Nisaver, who uses his platform at the Stilt Science on TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter to give people access to the practical applications of scientific knowledge in their lives. We ask him about the importance of getting people to reconnect with scientific thinking and how we might be able to re-establish trust in the information we see online.
Take a listen.
All right. My name is Avisha Nisaver, or at Distilled Science on the social medias. And my interest in the science really started a long time ago, back when I was in first grade. My parents decided to pull me out of school along with my older brother and homeschool me alongside a couple of friends. I grew up in a very religious household where we, at the time, were going to a school that taught both Judaics and secular studies. And what ended up happening was the secular studies taught at these schools, the math, the science, was just not up to speed for my parents and even myself at that age. I remember looking at my older brother's math homework and saying, I can do this. Why should I go to school? And my parents agreed. This pretty much fueled from a very young age a mentality of, we should be learning based on our curiosity, based on our own love of learning. So from that point, I basically had to learn how to learn in the most efficient way possible. In high school, I started writing a column about memorization techniques, ways to really use tricks to more efficiently study for tests. In college, I then wrote like a blog about, again, efficient study habits, ways of really optimizing your time for maximizing grades. And going forward from there, after working for a long time in the startup space in the many aspects of the health and wellness industry, I started realizing that people just don't have a good understanding of what science is, how science works, and how it can actually be practically applied to our daily lives. And when the pandemic hit and I started working with a venture capital firm tied into a lot of really cool emerging technologies that could make a difference in the current pandemic, I realized that the biggest problem was actually one of understanding and education, where people are so disconnected from the underlying scientific reality and have no way of applying that to their daily practices.
So given your passion for education and science, both, and education about science, what is your feeling about kind of how, do you sense that people are lacking in science, or there's a willingness to disbelieve or suspend belief about science in today's culture?
I think that there actually is a fundamental misunderstanding of what science is. Science is very, very simple. It's the ability to make an observation about the world, use that to inform some set of beliefs or understandings, and then to make a hypothesis based on that data that would in some way predict the world and see if that comes true. It's using data to constantly update our understanding of reality. That's all science is. And therefore, if you see something like a scientific organization making a statement and then changing that statement later, that means that science is working because they got new data and they changed their recommendation. As opposed to, in the last year especially, the way that science has been portrayed is, oh, this is what scientists say. Science says this. The number of times you see a headline that science says that like soda cures cancer in mice. Like, that's science, sure. I.e. science was involved at some point in the process, but that's very far removed from our actual understanding of things and how science actually works. When you go and you stop people on the street and you say, do you believe in science? What does that even mean? Believing in science, that should not be a phrase. You don't have to believe in science. Science is just a method. It's a way of understanding things.
How did we get there though? How do we get to the point where science is just as something you believe, just like your religion or your faith? How did we get to that point, do you think?
Well, the problem could be one of information overload, as well as our hierarchy of beliefs in general. So when we believe things, like there's a lot of studies that have been done on foundations of belief and how opinions form. And the mind is a very complicated piece of machinery that's really based on heuristics. We don't, if we form a belief, we come to it, but we rarely have an understanding of what the underpinnings of that belief are from a clear perspective. They've done studies where if you ask someone, do you believe X? And then you give them some potential reasonings or ask them to come up with their own reasonings. The two are often very unrelated, especially when it comes to politics, where you can say, this is something the Democratic Party says, do you believe it? And then people will say yes if they're a Democrat and no if they're a Republican. But if you say this is something the Republican Party says, and you're saying the same thing, you're saying something pretty obscure that you're telling them as part of their party's belief structure, then they will come up with some foundation for that belief. And that's something they would have made up on the spot ad hoc. It's not that their belief was informed by the reasoning. I mean, you see the same in neuroscience, where people literally have like a severed corpus callosum where their right brain and their left brain don't communicate. And the right brain might do something. And then you ask the left brain what's happening. And they just make up the most ridiculous explanations. Like they can't feel their arm. So you ask them what's happening. Like, oh yeah, that's my mother's arm. Actually a case study.
Yeah. I mean, that is a really interesting explanation for this kind of denial of science, and it carries out in so many areas. We've seen it heavily in the pandemic, you know, people not believing in vaccination or some other science around the pandemic, but also on bigger issues like climate change and whether or not that exists, or can we solve climate change through science? And you know, and I know that you have expertise in health. How do you see us reorienting back to those facts and making policy around facts?
Part of it will end up having to be building up a trust in certain institutions, as well as a lot of work alongside the worst offenders when it comes to the misinformation. So one of the issues is that if you exist in an information silo and all you're seeing are people saying one thing, the more times our mind sees something, the more we're likely to believe it, almost regardless of the source. Back in the jungle when we evolved, like there's no way to get exposed to things that weren't part of your reality. So the more you see something, the more relevance it has. The problem is when you have a social media platform that's just providing you information based on your existing belief structure because you're more likely to look at that. This is not a setup that is conducive towards the changing of beliefs. It's one that is very much designed to continue you along a path, radicalize you in some way, just because that increases the viewing metrics. So this is something that a lot of the social media companies now are at least getting to be somewhat involved in some way. I know that I'm part of an initiative of a lot of health influencers right now on TikTok, but on some of the other platforms as well, where we're actually working with the World Health Organization to try and combat misinformation on social media. And through the World Health Organization, they're actually having conversations with like Facebook and TikTok and Instagram, which is really Facebook, but they're actually discussing with these companies, trying to figure out ways of making accurate information rise to the top and fighting some of the misinformation.
Yeah, isn't this the very bottom of the dilemma of social media? Is this, you know, how do you get rid of, or who is validating misinformation? I think Facebook had this dilemma from its start, right? Is it a news company, or is it a, what they call themselves, like social media platform, basically not making any comments about whoever posts, whatever is posted? And it has kind of given its own ghosts. Yeah, I think there is some, I feel we can't get rid of it, but maybe you have a different opinion about this.
I don't think it's ever going to go away because we have this thing called freedom of speech. So we're not going to stop people from saying crazy things, but we can try and foster an understanding in the general population that there's a difference between someone saying something from a presumed position of authority, and someone saying something using data to back it. And we should be on the lookout for the latter. if someone says something and says, trust me because I have letters before or after my name, or trust me because I can make up my resume, that's very different than saying, trust me because of a highly powered, double-blinded, placebo-controlled clinical trial that backs up what I'm saying. Now, most people won't have the expertise to properly go and read through that trial, but the thing that some of these companies might be able to do is actually flag, you like, use a set of criteria to basically flag the reliability of data, the robustness of data. There's a whole hierarchy of things. There's observational trials, there's randomized controls trials, there's meta-analyses, there's overall guidelines from organizations. These are ways of categorizing data in terms of its strength, trustworthiness, and reliability. And if statements could be linked towards a reliability score in some way of the data backing, then that's a way of at least distinguishing and differentiating between someone saying something that they heard from their cousin's dog's other former owner's like cousin, and then instead saying, oh yeah, this has evidence behind it.
Are you saying that Facebook, Google, and who else TikTok. Is on TikTok should collaborate in order to change the system?
In some sense. So you, because of the whole freedom of speech thing, you never want to go and remove a platform, say people cannot actually go and say what they want. But what we are seeing is similarly to how these social media platforms no longer allow hate speech of a certain level, like you will get removed from the platform if you are flagged beyond a certain degree. That is something that you don't want to be done in a very controlling manner. Like there should be very careful thresholds, but there should be something that at least facilitates reliability, trustworthiness. It's even if it's as simple as making sure that everyone has either a flag for personal opinion versus reliability of data, and just making that a universal across platforms, like for people with X audience size, perhaps, to actually ensure that the reliability of what people are seeing on the platform, like no individual has the time to go through and fact check everything they see. So instead, they use little heuristics that are shortcuts that people often take advantage of. Like X doctor comes out saying this. Well, we're used to trusting doctors. But unfortunately, we've learned in the last year that just because you're a doctor doesn't mean you know anything about the topic at hand. A doctor is not an epidemiologist, is not a virologist, is not a public health expert, and oftentimes is not even an expert in the bodily systems that are involved in the current matter at hand. Like, he's a doctor, but maybe he's a veterinarian. That's happened.
Do you see an automated way to do this fact-checking, for example, with the advent of blockchain technologies and smart contracts where kind of it takes out the trust factor a bit and you can actually verify for a supply chain or a data bank? Or and how do you see that new technology playing in this role?
So coming from the startup world, anytime we say, well, let's just add blockchain and make this all work. I've been on panels where I'm judging other startups, and anytime they say we use a blockchain-backed technology, I ask them to explain how their tech would work if they did not use a blockchain and instead used a database. If they can really answer that question well, then they probably don't need to be using a blockchain. I bring that up just because I think there are so many amazing uses for blockchain that we're going to start seeing going forwards. I'm not sure that this in particular is one of them, though, because on the one hand, yes, blockchain allows for the cryptographic verification of all different types of information. And yes, it's possible that some of our data sources may end up being cryptographically sealed on a blockchain in some way. But what we're talking about is a little bit more of the social problem, where the issue is not trusting that a research study is from a reliable source. Mostly, I mean, there's occasional issues there, but it's not that we're saying someone is publishing a research study under a false name and you can't trust who they are or that some hacker is putting it out. The problem is that nobody's even looking at the research studies. No one is having the ability to take it down to that level. So I don't know that blockchain is the solution in this context, but it could be that if we were to create enough of an infrastructure around it, wherein you had a very concrete way of defining thresholds in reliability of data. And then we're able to do something like create a smart contract based on a certain data reliability threshold being reached for then allowing certain economic gains. There could be a way of arranging that that would make use of that type of platform.
It's more like, maybe not, I mean, we don't necessarily need blockchain, but the decentralized web, I do think, kind of offers content providers a lot more freedom. Basically, our content we do here for the podcast is basically owned by iTunes, you know, as soon as you enter the iTunes platform. And if you like it or not, those companies will control at any given moment whatever we put out there, and our time and energy has been put in there. So, and that's a sort of an ownership, I think, which has to be discussed, which I see as a huge, huge problem for centralized use of the internet as we are still using it today.
And I definitely agree with you there. It would be fantastic if we were not reliant upon these single big companies for controlling all of our content. The number of people like in the group of healthcare influencers I was talking about before, oftentimes it's this constant battle between the people trying to give accurate information and the trolls and anti-vaxxers and these people who often come together and mass report someone's educational video because it says something they don't like. And then the automated system takes it off the platform. Then it's a constant fight to get it back on. And that is an avenue through which, like, if someone has spent a year building up a following of 100,000 people and then suddenly gets their account deleted based on some automated system, yeah, that definitely is disadvantageous for the content creator. And at the same time, it also doesn't provide any type of personal financial incentive for said creator to actually do all the work that they're doing. It makes them very much dependent on the third party. So it would be amazing if we could actually shift towards a dissociated, distributed social network that is not controlled by any centralized party, but instead has some loose oversight through a more democratic means.
Alicia, I'd like to switch to some of the big problems that we tackle here on this podcast. And, you know, we primarily are focused on income disparity or resource disparity and the impact of our economic system on climate change. I mean, those are really our two main things. And you speak a lot about habitat and health, personal health, and how to make those be more part of your life through science also. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your thoughts on solving these problems and how would you approach those as science guy on TikTok?
When it comes to environments, I think there are many ways that they impact performance and health and overall socioeconomic status in ways that people don't really think about. So I've spent a lot of time in the last year in the air quality space, looking at, first from a COVID perspective, what environments are conducive for the transmission of disease. Then from there, as I started doing more and more reading, more and more digging, I started to realize just how many other aspects of our environments, things that could exist in our air, could have a very strong impact on not just our risk for disease, not just our overall respiratory health, but even our risk for things like neurodegenerative diseases, our performance on cognitive tests, grades, can all be impacted by things that we breathe in or don't breathe in every day. There was a gas leak out in California a handful of years ago, and it created this interesting environment where in a 5-mile radius, the government partnered with the gas company responsible for the leak and decided to go and put air purification devices in the homes and schools everywhere within that 5-mile radius because they wanted to make sure that they were trying to pull the like methane out of the air and fix their mistake and give people good air to breathe. What ended up happening is that it took a couple of months for them to get these units installed. And at that point, the ambient levels had actually pretty much dissipated and it wasn't a big problem. But what happened was they had now installed all of these devices in a very clear circle where all the other factors were pretty much the same on both sides of the dividing line. it just happened to be that in one side they installed these units, in the other side they didn't. And for the next several years, they were doing follow-ups looking at, okay, but can we tell any difference from like in the classrooms and homes for breathing the cleaner air? And what they found was actually an increase in average student grades, almost comparable to lowering classroom sizes by a third and more cost-effective than hiring private tutors. It's not like everyone went from B's to A's, but the statistical significance of the shift was such that that was a big difference just from breathing cleaner air. And that's a low-cost intervention. That's a Band-Aid style intervention. So yeah, it would be much better if the air wasn't polluted in the first place. And that's a larger scale problem, both nationally and globally. But I think that's something we absolutely need to approach from both sides of the spectrum. We need to be doing everything in our power to reduce emissions, actually stop polluting our air so much. But at the same time, there are many ways where we can take the air that we're actually breathing for 90% of our time that we spend indoors and make that safer. And that applies both to our bodies and our brains.
You touched on such an important topic, which is getting people related again to science in a way that's not about a belief or anything. It's just our senses observing data and predicting new future based on that data. And I think that's such a profound message because we've got to figure out how to act in unison again. And the only way to do that is if we have a common idea of what reality is. You know, we can't act in unison without a common reality. And it feels to me like reality is subjective to the point where it's like playing on a team lately. Like you said, you know, you're playing on a team, which reality you're dealing with. And science actually is the answer to that.
Yeah, there is a fascinating short story that I read many years ago that it gives a hypothetical scenario where all humans are basically forced underground because the environment has been entirely destroyed. And we have to build up our civilization again many miles below the earth to the point where we can no longer go on the surface and it becomes a myth. Nobody alive remembers the surface. We have no actual full records of it. And we just have little snatches of information. And a phrase that is often repeated is the cerulean sky. And in this underground society, there ends up being a very large debate about what color is cerulean actually? Is it green or is it blue? Nobody really knows, but it becomes a very heated issue and you have people lining up on both sides and you've got the blue group and the green group. And it ends up being a focal point around a large political debate. And you end up having these two parties form, one very focused on blue and one very focused on green. And over time, these parties become associated with many other aspects of their society, where the blue group is all for expanding in the Eastern Caverns, and who knows what other political issues they may be facing down there. But what happens is, eventually, you have everyone so aligned with blue and green and all these sub-beliefs, but finally someone goes and they make it to the surface, and they look up and they see the sky. And the question then is, what does that do to the underlying belief structure for these parties that are so based on an arbitrary top-level belief when the other ones should not actually be linked to it? It's, I think, a problem at the core of a bipartisan political system and just the way that we approach life in general. And it's not our fault because it's based on natural cognitive biases. But it's something that we really need to be struggling to overcome if we want to move to the point of rational thought and decision-making.
I have one more question for you. You mentioned that you come from a very religious background. And, you know, one of the makeups or assumptions that I have about kind of this party-like system around believing in science or practicing science is that religion often plays a role in convincing people not to delve into science. Do you have a different kind of experience? Or how do you navigate religious belief versus science?
It's a question that I wish were irrelevant, but unfortunately is not. There is a study or a preprint study published today looking at vaccination rates in Israel. And they found that the group that had the lowest vaccination rates was actually the ultra-Orthodox community. And yes, this is somewhat indicative of a trending, I'd call it, belief structure against trusting science to the proper degree, but I don't think that that's intrinsic to religiosity. Albert Einstein was Jewish. I mean, he wasn't religious after a certain point in life, but there are many, many scientists that are fully religious, and the two really can go hand in hand, because saying that there is a prime mover, so to speak, that doesn't mean that it's not being moved according to set principles. If you say that the world is created by a God, that doesn't mean that it was like, okay, if he's all-knowing and all-powerful and can create things according to a set of rules, why shouldn't those rules be studyable, learnable, usable to actually enhance our own existence? We should be able to examine the world around us, make observations, predictions, and move forwards with that. There's absolutely nothing about believing in a God that should make the belief in our own powers of observation obviated.
Wonderful interview. Thank you so much, Avisha. Anything else for you?
Is there anything, Avisha, we haven't asked you where you thought, like, this is crucial to you?
I guess one quick thing on the air purification space. Not all devices are created equal. And there's a lot of science involved in figuring out proper ways of protecting yourself.
Well, follow, say your TikTok channel again.
So my TikTok is at Distilled Science. Same at this point on Instagram, Twitter, and such. So,
yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Right. I mean, we talked a lot about social media, and you can, I think he decided to put his knowledge and his learning out into the web. And there is, it's for us, by the way, it's the same thing, right? We are content providers. We can put as many fact-driven episodes out there and interview people with real science background. And we do. There's a lot of knowledge there we are tapping into. And there will be, no matter what, there will be some sort of, no, this is not true, and some, how do you say?
But also algorithms that will direct our content to people who will want to listen to it and not necessarily to all the people who could benefit from that content.
Right, and this is the coded bias, which goes inherently with a centralized platform. You know, and I do see a lot of potential in decentralized systems.
Or even just neutral, nonprofit-driven platforms. I mean, I actually don't think you necessarily have to be completely decentralized in order to be credible. Right. But to eliminate some of these deep profit incentives that have people buying our data, selling our data, directing facts or non-facts based on what the following will be. You know, and that's... You know, that's the marketplace, granted, but it's not necessarily facts. And one of the beautiful things that Avisha, I think, is saying is, look, you know, facts are not partisan. They're just facts, you know, and we should be able to just take them and move from there.
Maybe you should all do homeschooling, you know, like learn in a bubble, in your own speed. I really like that, you know, without all the constraints of school, instead of let's have this kind of new kind of learning evolve, not constrained, not in a box, not in silos. That would be lovely. I would love to just, and lifelong, you know, it doesn't stop at the age of 18.
But then,
and
your
pop
entire,
out into college,
then your entire fate is based on what your parents can provide to you. And I don't think that's necessarily a recipe for equity.
Yeah, but couldn't there be a sharing of, like, I can choose to.
Yeah, it's called public school.
You know how good public school is at the moment. This is probably why there are so many private schools in this country.
Yeah.
Which really is part of the inequality system, right? If you don't pay for your education, you basically don't get education. Sorry that I'm so harsh on all these teachers who I know that they are trying to do a really good job in public school. But if you're not given the infrastructure, you can't beat that private charter school system. You can't. there's too much money in it, and it's biased.
Yeah. I mean, look, all comes down to basically a very big theme for us, which is we need to invest in the commons, protect the commons, have people more conscious about the commons, and one of those commons is education.
Or knowledge in general.
Or knowledge in general.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.